Go ahead and turn in your Bibles, if you would, please, to Ruth, the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. We're in Ruth. Let's go ahead and turn to chapter 4, if you're there. And we're going to read why we're working through Ruth. Chapter 4, let's start in verse 13. We'll read through the end of the chapter. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without," bing, 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 "a redeemer. May his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. You don't hear that name very often. It means worshiper. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. Well, as we've begun to walk through the promise of God back in Genesis 3:15, we've been looking at the seed of the woman. We've seen that God is not just reacting to man's sin, but he's proactive in bringing about man's salvation. God was not unaware that man would fall. He knew that it was going to happen, and he had prepared in advance. He's not responding to and kind of backpedaling and coming up with a plan on the fly. But as God is working out man's salvation, because his ways aren't our ways, he's doing so in ways that we would not. And so we've seen that this promise comes, it's the proto or the first evangelium, the first announcement of the gospel given to Eve there in the garden, that there would be a snake crusher, right? And so we see Eve turned to Mary, who represents that one day there will be the defeat of that which has introduced death into this story. But in the process of crushing the serpent's head, the serpent would bite the Savior's heel. And so we've seen that while the fall came because Eve took of the fruit of one tree, there was still one tree that she had not taken the fruit of. And because of that, God says, "We're going to keep you from that tree of life, because if you were to access it at this point, you would actually lock in death. You'd be forever walking in a living death and separation from that which is life. But I promise you life by removing the death bringer in this story. But the only way to access that life is by another tree of life. A tree that's going to raise up this snake crusher in death to bring you life. This is a tree that offers life, life that's not taken, life that is given. All you can do with this offer is receive it." And as Corey so well articulated for us this morning, and Alex as well, at the age of 10, a 10-year-old can receive this gift. But it does require working through the process of saying, "I'm nothing, I can't, he's everything. He has." Praise God. It's really that simple. But you have to work through it. You can't just believe it. The devils believe, and they tremble. You have to receive it. It's like that gift that's sitting there under the tree. It has your name on it. But it does you no good unless you open it up and begin to enjoy it. God on the outside of life, becoming God on the inside of your life. So we've looked at God's ways, and they're strange ways, but they're effective ways. And what we saw when we came to Leah, we saw that she's the one who brings the joyful praises of God's people into articulation as she names her fourth child, Judah. In Yahweh, I give praise. This is after three others that she's naming because she's hoping that maybe this child will earn her the love of her husband, and it never does. And so in this heart of Leah, we see the sorrow of rejection. She's the unloved wife. It's such a tragic story, yet it's the unloved wife of Jacob that becomes the matriarch of God's people. She's the one who's buried with her husband in Machpelah. She's the one who has 6 out of 12 tribes named in Israel. And then, as we watched how this comes through, we see that her seed comes to these broken hearts in order that he might transform these broken hearts to sing God's praise. This is what the Redeemer does, because this is who the Redeemer is. He's the seed of the woman, but he's also going to be a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Then we moved a little farther in the story and we saw Tamar. Tamar, who brings the lion of the tribe of Judah. And we saw that Judah has 3 children with a Canaanite wife. And the first two, God directly intervenes and takes them out of the picture because they were wicked. They were sinful. And God directly intervenes in the life of Judah and his sons and takes them out of the picture. And he promises his youngest son to Tamar that she would still have an inheritance within God's people. She'd be taken care of, that there'd be welfare on her behalf. And yet, he's afraid. He's afraid because his 2 sons have died, and he thinks it's because of her rather than because of them. The Bible tells us it's because of them, because of their sin, that they're dead. So he's reluctant in giving his last child to this woman who seems to be bad luck. But as she puts on the disguise and woos her father-in-law to her bed and gets pregnant by him, when it's all said and done, Judah's left saying, "Bring her out and kill her." She says, "It's by the man to whom these belong that I'm pregnant." And he says, "Stop. She's more righteous than I." And so we have this woman whose story is framed by injustice. She's taken to be a wife for the son of Judah, and then she's used, she's abused, she's thrown aside, gotten out of the way, and then she's incorporated. Not because others want to bring her in, but she believes that there's something to be had with these people who are the people of the blessing. And so we see that the righteousness of the deceptive daughter-in-law preserves the unrighteous line of Judah. Judah was doing everything he could to bring an end to his line. Judah was doing everything he could to self-destruct. And God uses this wayward, deceptive, immoral daughter-in-law to bring about the lion of the tribe of Judah. Wow. You couldn't write this stuff. God had to. And so this is the beauty of God's grace as he weaves his goodness in the midst of our badness. We being bad, he brings good, and he brings more good than we bring bad. It's an unbelievable, it's an unfair exchange, but it's so beautiful. And now we come this morning to Ruth. And in the book of Ruth, we find the noble kinsman redeemer. But as we've seen with the other ladies, we find that there is a sorrow in this story that's woven into it. It's the sorrow of emptiness. And as we watch this story begin to take shape, we're going to see that as Naomi leaves Bethlehem, literally the house of bread, and goes into Moab, that her life is going to become darker and darker and darker, slimmer and slimmer and slimmer. It's become less and less and less. And it's in this context that God is going to take the initiatives to, again, weave his story through the story of a woman as he brings forth his seed. What I want us to see from this story this morning is this, that the seed of the woman comes to the hopeless that he might fill them with hope. But not just a generic hope. It's a hope that's in him. And so as we're working through this morning, I want you to see that the first part of the story is bringing us down into hopelessness. And then as we watch God taking the initiative, it's restoring hope, but it's not just a generic hope. It's not even a hope in blessing. It becomes a hope that's very, very personal and very, very relational. So as we work through this morning, we're going to see four ways in which God's messianic grace takes the initiative in the midst of hopelessness. What does this look like? In chapter 1, Ruth chapter 1, God removes the option of all other resources. Let's go to chapter 1, see how this story starts. It says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So if you're reading through this in your devotional plan, you're reading through the Bible, and you come to this line, it's like, yep, okay, so that's the setting. In the days when the judges ruled, wait a minute, it just told you a whole bunch of information in that little line. Where does Ruth fit, at least in our English Bible? Joshua, Judges, Ruth, right? In the Hebrew Bible, it's a little bit different, but usually it comes in the same place. Sometimes it comes with the writings. Sometimes it's celebrated. They read the book of Esther at the time of Passover, and then they'll read the book of Ruth way down at Pentecost, would be the feast that they would read that with regard to. It'd be in the writings. But usually, Ruth is couched right here between Judges and Samuel, because it's in the days that the judges ruled that this story takes place. What was the movement during this time? Israel, who'd come out of Egypt, who's been redeemed, who is God's people and who are called to be holy, they fall into sin. And with their sin doesn't come blessing. It comes God's judgment. That's Deuteronomy chapter 28. If you obey, there's blessing. If you disobey, there's curses and there's going to be judgment. And so with their sin, God brings them into servitude. Sometimes he uses different peoples. At one point, he used the Moabites. Okay, Moabites, Judges. We've got two really big names that should be really familiar as we're reading through this text. Well, in the midst of their servitude, they cry out. They supplicate God and say, we've sinned. Please help us. We're your people. Be true to us. Show us your loving kindness. And God does. Not because they deserve it, but because he is who he is. He's a God who is abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, despite his people's unfaithfulness. And so this is the cycle that they've been going through for some time, but we come down to the end of the book of Judges. In fact, just turn one page back if you don't have a study Bible. But the last verse in the book of Judges is this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what? Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Okay, that's the context in which we pick up this story. Everybody is doing right in his own eyes. So, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Well, why would there be a famine in the land? What did God say? What kind of a land is he bringing his people to? A land that flows with milk and honey. Okay, a land that flows with milk and honey is not a land of famine. Those two are opposite ends of the equations. The only way that this promised land, a land of milk and honey, can be experiencing a famine is if the people have sinned. Bing, bing, bing. That's the context. People have sinned. Well, how are we going to solve this problem? Well, we're going to fall into servitude or at least some sort of trouble, right? And then we're going to supplicate. So that's what we're looked to expect. So there's this problem because of sin. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah prayed to God and asked to provide food for his family. No, that's not what it says. A man in Bethlehem did that which was right in his own eyes. And he went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. This ties in very, very deeply with where we've been. What's the first curse in the garden when Eve sins? God turns and curses the serpent, right? The second curse, he curses the ground. Here we have a ground that's cursed. And we're told that in Deuteronomy chapter 11, that this only happens because of sin. He says, you shall keep my whole commandment and go in and take possession of this land that I promised, this land flowing with milk and honey, because it's a land that you don't have to irrigate. It drinks in the water of heaven. God will rain on it. It's a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of God are on this from the beginning of the year to the end. This is in God's perspective. So I command you, love the Lord your God in all your heart, and he will give you grass in your fields, and you shall eat and be full. There's a famine. Down to verse 21. Ironic, it's in a famine, and Naomi says, when I left here, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Are you hearing themes that are more than just circumstantial? These are themes that are covenantal. These are themes that are biblical. What God has said is going to happen is happening. And God is being true to his word. And every man is doing what's right in his own eyes. God says, you be careful, because if you disobey me, if you do what's right in your own eyes rather than listening to my instruction, you will perish quickly off the good land that I'm giving you. And they're finding that it's almost impossible to stay alive in this land, so they're going to look someplace other than God for God's blessing. That makes no sense, does it? Boy, are those people stupid. I'm sure glad we're not like them, right? We never look someplace other than God for God's blessing. Of course, that's not true. We do. That's exactly what we do. And so before we start passing judgment too quickly in this story, let us for a moment consider that perhaps this story is more about us than what we care to admit. So that's the setup for the story. A man of Bethlehem went to sojourn in the land of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. Okay, so that sounds pretty innocuous. They went from Pennsylvania to Ohio. I mean, far better than going from Pennsylvania to New Jersey. Okay, so maybe this is like a New Jersey state. You don't really want to go there, but there's Cape May and there's the seashore. So you got to do what you got to do. Now, let's understand what Moab is. Moab, the beginning of Moab, they're descendants of Lot. Lot, who had a wife, Lot, who had daughters. Sons-in-law didn't come out with him. The angels grab him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and they bring them out because they're living in a world that is just marred by sinfulness. Sexual sin, homosexuality is just an ugly place in which to do life, and God is bringing his judgment. In bringing this judgment, God said, don't turn back. Don't long for what you're losing, because I'm bringing you to life from this city in context of death. His wife turns around, becomes a pillar of salt. He and his two daughters keep on moving. They go to a place to get out of the way. They end up in a cave. And the oldest daughter, probably infected, not probably, infected by the world in which she lived, says, hey, younger sister, we've got to think through, how are we going to have children? There's no men for us here. Let's get dad drunk and sleep with dad. That's exactly what they do. Oldest one does it first. The second one does it the next night. They both become pregnant by their own father. the word Moab, this story is told in Genesis 19, but the word Moab literally means from father. My child is from my father. It's an incestuous relationship. That's the beginnings of this illustrious people group. We move a little farther in the story and we come to the book of Numbers, Numbers 23, 24, and we find Balaam. Balaam is hired by Balak, and he's to curse the people of God. Balak is the king of Moab. So Balaam is hired to bring about this curse, and as he's trying to curse Israel, he sees that God is talking about a king. And he sees Israel as a lion and this king springing forth like a lion. A lion like the tribe of Judah. In fact, he says, from this people, I see a scepter, a star is rising. And this people will become so prominent and they will rule and have dominion over you, Balak, over the Moabites. Well, as he's telling him this, he doesn't like it, so he has to say it three different times. And he says, listen, I can't do anything but bless these people. And so he keeps telling him about this king that's coming. And Balak's getting a little more worried all the time. This is in Numbers 25 then. We're not told anything more. Other than we have people from Moab coming and the daughters of Moab coming and giving an invitation to the sons of Israel. Say, hey, why don't you come to a feast with us? And they go to the feast. They have a good time. They eat. They drink. They're merry. And then they said, why don't you sleep with us? And the men of Israel sleep with the Moabites, and 24,000 people die. Why? Because Balaam said, listen, the only way that you can get at them is to get them to sin against their God. Their God is for them, not against them. But if you can turn them against their God, if you can get them to sin, their God will bring judgment on them. You can't do anything to them, but they can self-destruct. That's exactly what he gets them to do. Keep your hand in the book of Ruth, but go to Deuteronomy 23. Because of what Moab has done in trying to draw Israel away from her God, God pronounces a judgment on Moab in particular. Deuteronomy 23. He's already told them back in chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, listen, do not mix with the peoples of this land. If you do, they'll draw your heart away from God. Deuteronomy 23, verse 2. No one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord. No Ammonite, that's the younger daughter's son, and no Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. This is why you cannot mingle with these people. These people will not be allowed in my presence. They are under my judgment. So, this is the context that Elimelech decides, hey, this is a great idea. I'm going to walk away from where it's tough to live, and I'm going to go to a place that God has promised to curse. That just doesn't even make sense, right? And so the story continues. So they went into the country of Moab. Right there in verse 2, end of the verse. They went into the country of Moab. They went to sojourn, but they end up remaining there. Remaining does not equal sojourning. Motel 8 does not equal your home address. They change their plans. And as they're there, not only did they remain there, but it says, verse 4, they lived there about 10 years. And in the process, they died there. Elimelech dies. Mahlon dies. Chilion dies. Dad, who does right in his own eyes, brings his boys with him. Dad suffers because of his sin. His children buy into his sin. His children suffer the same death as their father. Don't you love hearing Alex's story? I was 10 years old. And you know how I found Christ? My father took me into my room and said, "Listen, son, let me tell you about my Savior. He's my Savior. I needed him first. I'm telling you, because you're just like me, you need him too. Well done, Dad." Dad, you bring your kids on a journey of faith or faithlessness. You are a leader, ipso facto. You don't get to choose if you're going to be a leader. It's what kind of a leader are you? Guys, just by being a man, you are a leader. It doesn't matter what the world is saying. Ladies are watching you. Your sisters are watching you. People are watching you. You're a leader. What kind of a leader are you? Because where you lead and others follow, they follow you into the same life or death into which you lead them. So Elimelech, oh, by the way, do you know what Elimelech means, the name? Eli, El is God, like Elohim. The little I is a pronominative suffix, and it means belonging to me. The God who belongs to me is the Melech, the king. He's my king. He's the one that I look to provide all my needs. Yeah, it looks like he's not doing a very good job. Let's go over here. Elimelech. Wow. So this is the story of chapter 1. But what we see is that God is beginning to undermine Elimelech's plan. Why did he go to Moab? He went to Moab because there's no food, right? He's going there for other options, for other resources, because obviously God's not working for me. So I've got to make a way for myself and find other options in order to exist. And God is slowly removing those options, taking away their ability to live. Number two, he leads his people to places where he's already at work. So his boys marry these Moabite wives. In fact, it doesn't just say they married him, it says they took them. This kind of language reminds us of Genesis chapter 6, where men are just taking wives for themselves. They took wives, and they die there. Verse 6, then Naomi arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. Ah, so Naomi is now becoming a major part of this story. The men who have brought her into this place of death are gone. And now she becomes prominent as a character. And she hears that God visits his people. That is, God has come near either to bless or to curse. Well, the fact that there's food means he's in the midst of blessing this people. Something's changed. And so she hears that God's presence now is working out for the benefit of his people, and she's going to turn and be a part of that because all she's experiencing at this point is death. So she blesses the girls and says goodbye. They refuse to go. And then she starts to explain, listen, we've got this custom, and it's not just us. It's kind of an ancient Near Eastern thing where if I were to have another child, that one could become your husband, and you could have children with them. I owe you the next child. She says, I'm too old. And even if I had a child in 9 months, I got pregnant tonight, had a child in 9 months, are you going to wait for 15, 16, 18 years before that child is old enough to become your husband? Ladies, go back. Go back to your parents. Go back and live in your mother's house, your father's house. Go back and take your gods. She explains her predicament. And Orpah leaves, but Ruth remains. And you got to love Ruth because she's so simple, right? Let's go down to verse 15. Naomi turns to Ruth and says, Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and back to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God will be my God. This is her conversion. This is where she says, listen, I want to be like you. That is, I want your God to be my identity. This is what God had told his people back in Exodus chapter 6, verse 7. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. Ruth is saying the exact same thing in reverse. Listen, I will take you, God, to be my God, so that I, Ruth, can be one of your people. That's awesome. She's confessing him. She's asking him. She's calling on his name. This is when Ruth becomes one who's believing in the living, true God. So as we watch Naomi, she's coming back to the place where God's at work, and she's excited to be a part of that. Ruth is going to join her. And verse 19, the two of them go until they come to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town is stirring because of them. And the women of the town said, is this Naomi? What we see is as Naomi focuses on all of her hurts, that she's become bitter. Her name actually means the one who is pleasant or sweet. Naomi. I mean, it sounds just beautiful, doesn't it? She says, wait a minute. Verse 20, do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, which means bitter. Why? Because the Lord Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full. He's brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity on us? So she starts to say, listen, call me bitter. That's what I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. In fact, you know whose fault it is that I'm bitter? It's God's. The God that you worship has turned himself against me. Forget the fact that I walked away from him. He's turned his back on me. He's dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full. I've come back empty, and it's God's fault. Wow. That takes some guts, doesn't it? So, in contrast to Naomi, you have Ruth. God has been at work back in Judah, but God has been working in Ruth's life, right? Where she chooses Naomi and calls on God to be her God. This is the expression of her conversion. She moves to Bethlehem with Naomi, which means she has to leave mom. She has to leave dad. She has to leave her land, her kinsmen. She's leaving all of her family, all of her security, all of her identity behind her, and she's trading it in and banking everything on the God of a foreign land. A God, mind you, who has put her people under a curse. But she's trusting in this God. God is working in Ruth's heart. This isn't just something that Ruth is taking the initiative. God is working behind the scenes and underneath the surface in this woman's heart to draw her through a bitter woman to a loving God. That's pretty amazing when you stop and think about it. So God provides food in Israel, but he also leads her to Boaz's field. Let's go down to verse 22, chapter 1, verse 22. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, and they returned to from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. She said to her, go. So she went out and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she just so happened to come to the part of the field that belonged to Boaz. You know who he is. She doesn't. But as God is beginning to take initiatives in this story, not only working in the life of Ruth, not only working in the land of Judah, he brings Ruth to Judah and now brings Ruth to Boaz. And the text highlights it. It just so happened. It's kind of a little tongue-in-cheek. We know who's working behind the scenes, right? The same God who brought food to his people, the one who is visiting his people, is doing this thing behind the scenes. And then Boaz blesses her by the name of Yahweh. And so as Boaz comes on the scene, verse 4, behold, Boaz comes from Bethlehem. He says to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." They answered, "Boaz, the Lord bless you." Remember, this is in the times of the judges where everybody's operating by their own standards, by what's right in their own eyes. At least in Boaz's life, there's a defining core. God isn't on the outside of his life. God is at the center of his life. And so even in his greetings, he's greeting people by the goodness of a good God. And so this isn't just throwaway words. It's not just a God bless the USA at the end of a prayer or a speech. This is, may God, the living God, bless you. He finds out who Ruth is. He asks one of his employees there, who is this woman? And he says, it's Ruth, the woman who came back from Naomi, from the country of Moab. And she asked for permission to glean here. So verse 8, Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, don't go glean in another field. Stay close by my women. It's a dangerous place. Every man does what's right in his own eyes. Keep your eyes here on the field that you're reaping. Go after my ladies. And then it says, when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn for my workers. I want to take care of you. Verse 10, she fell on her face and bowed to the ground and said, why have I found favor in your eyes? Why did you take notice of me? I'm a foreigner, and not just any foreigner. I'm one of the condemned foreigners. I'm one of those who's not even allowed into the temple precinct. I don't fit. I don't belong. I am unworthy. And we're told in verse 1 that he is worthy. The idea there is he's substantive. When Boaz speaks, people stop to listen. And we'll see exactly how that works in chapter 4. But Boaz has what he needs to bless others. He has all of the resources to make it happen because God's blessed Boaz, right? So God brings Naomi and Ruth to the land of Judah where he's at work. He brings them to the life of Boaz where he's at work. And under the surface, he's working in Ruth's life, and you wouldn't know it just yet, but under the surface, he's working in Naomi's life as well. And so, let's listen a little bit farther down. Verse 11, Boaz answered her and says, listen, Ruth, all that you've done for your mother-in-law has been told to me. How you've left your father and your mother, your native land. You've come to a people you didn't even know. Verse 12, may the Lord repay you for what you've done. May a full reward be given to you by this living God, the God of Israel, not Moab, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And so he blesses her by the God that she's chosen to identify with. So Ruth begins to look at all these blessings in her life, and it's changing her from the inside out. So she says, listen, maybe God will give us more, right? Maybe he'll help me to find favor in somebody's eyes. And when she does find the favor, she doesn't presume upon it. Well, you better have done that for me. Your law said you were supposed to, right? She's, why would you take notice of me? Why would you bless me? I'm an outsider. And then she says, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I'm not even one of your servants. You've shown kindness to me. You've shown chesed to me. You have shown me the character of your God. Why would you do that to me? You do have a good God. You know how I know? Because I see God at work in you. Wow. What a testimony, huh? Ruth is able to look at Boaz and say, Boaz, I know what your God looks like because I see him in you. That's exactly what Jesus tells us. It's our job, right? Matthew chapter 5. Verse 13 down through verse 16, he says, you are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You live in such a way so that others can see your God in you. And she does. And she starts to grow. Now we come to Boaz. So Boaz has been kind to her. He's given to her a lot of different things. Let's go down to verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz says to Ruth, come up here. Let's eat some bread. Dip your morsel in the wine. Forget about the water for now. Take some of the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. Yep, whatever. No, this is some of the grain that they've already taken, and he's roasted. This is like a dessert. This is a treat. This is giving her the extras. It's not just bread and water. He's giving her something that's rich, something that's exorbitant. And so he passes her the roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied. In fact, there was some left over. And then when she rises to glean, he tells her, listen, go ahead and pull a little bit out. Leave some extra for her. And don't rebuke her for taking anything. So she gleans all the way till the evening, and she brings back home what she has to her mother-in-law, and it was about an ephah of barley, about 6 or 7 pounds of grain. That's a lot. She had to glean it, she had to beat it, and then she had to gather it, and she gathered up about 6, 7. This didn't happen from just the gleanings, all right? Somebody's helping her out. That somebody is Boaz, but that somebody is God. The God under whose wings you have come to find refuge. That's the blessing that he's given to her. So she tells her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law looks at it and says, verse 19, where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Wow, you brought a lot of stuff home. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she'd worked. She said, the man's name is Boaz. And all of a sudden, Naomi puts two and two together. She says, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose chesed has not forsaken the living or the dead. And Naomi said to her, that man is a close relative of ours. He's one of our goel. He's one of our redeemers. The idea behind the redeemer is that he's the one who holds the family name, which means he also holds the family's welfare in his hands. He's the one who's on the lookout to make sure that his people have what they need to succeed. He's a father figure. He's a pastoral figure in this. And he's looking for the welfare of his people. She says, that's who he is for us. He's a near kinsman with the right of redemption. He's responsible for the name and for the welfare of all that belongs to him. And all that belongs to him is all that's related to him. He's described as a worthy man. That is, he's one who has valor, virtue, strength. It also denotes prosperity that accompanies this virtue. This is a man that you want on your side. A simple term is, he's a hero. This is the one, when you're a kid, you're on the playground, you say, my dad's bigger than your dad, right? That's the idea here. He's a worthy man. He's the one who carries the weight and has what he needs to back it up. So with regard to how was Israel supposed to treat certain people in Israel, there were certain people that God wanted his people to take care of. Those people were the sojourner, like Ruth, the fatherless, like Ruth, because there's no father for her here, and the widow, like Ruth. Okay, she kind of qualifies on all three accounts. Deuteronomy, your God executes justice for the fatherless, the widow, and loves the sojourner, so you should too. You shall tithe of all your increase so that these may be filled. You shall include them in your worship feasts. You shall not pervert justice for them or take advantage of them. And when you reap your harvest and beat your olive trees and gather your grapes, remember them as God has remembered you. And Boaz is living this out. Why is he kind to Ruth? Because she was pretty. No. She may have been. We're not told. She might have been dog ugly. We don't know. But he's kind to her because he knows God's kindness in his life. And God told him to be kind to her. That's why he's doing what he's doing. And in doing so, he's giving a beautiful picture of his God. But if we let them, God's good initiatives in our lives can break down those barriers of bitterness. Did you see what Naomi said there in verse 20? May the man be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken me. You know what? I said God forgot about me. I said God's against me. I spoke too soon. Anytime before we're dead that we say God is against us, we're saying it too soon. The only way that God is against you, my friend, is if for your whole life you have refused his grace and you come to the end of your life and you've said no, 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 no. When you die, then God is against you. But until then, he's for you. And up until your dying breath, you too can do what Corey did on that date that she remembers so well. All you have to say is, I can't, you can, you did, and I receive it. For God so loved the world. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God is for you, not against you. So Naomi says, maybe I spoke too soon. God hasn't forgot his kindness to me. So God has removed other options. He's brought them to places and to people where he is at work. And then he requires a faith that requires an activity on Ruth's part. We're not going to go into the whole just because of time, which is convenient because it's the awkward part of the story, right? Go uncover his feet. It's like, whoo, that's kind of weird. But what we see with this story is we have a young lady going to a man who calls her daughter, uncovering his feet at night, pulling back the covers. We have a very close scenario to the same thing that we have in the Moab story, right? Where the daughter comes to a man who's drunk, and she comes to Boaz after his heart is made light by drinking. She uncovers him and lays at his feet. And she wants no more than that. She says, would you please be the answer to your own prayer? Would you cover me? She uses the same idea that Boaz had used in saying, you've come under the wing of God. She says, will you put your wing over me? Would you fulfill that for me? This is a step of faith. This could have turned Boaz against her. This could have jeopardized everything. But let's look at what Boaz says to her in chapter 3, verse 11. He wakes up, verse 9, he says, who are you? She says, I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you're my redeemer. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first in what you've done, and not going after young men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. What an amazing thing. As he turns to her, he says, listen, I will do what you ask because you are a worthy woman. It's the same word that's used as Boaz. It's only used of women three other times in Scripture, all of them in the book of Proverbs. The excellent wife, the excellent wife. You have done excellently. That's used of Ruth. She has a different spirit. She has a heart that's one with God. So as she's exercising faith, not knowing where it's going to take her, finally we come down to the fact that God works in ways that afford no alternative explanations. Boaz says, hey, I'll do this for you. But there's another guy who's closer. And we're all like, oh, Boaz. We're cheering for Boaz. It's like the Hallmark story, right? You're falling in love with Boaz. You're getting ready for this cute couple. They're going to get married and bum, 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 bum. There's another cute cousin in the mix and he's coming to town tomorrow. Oh no, what's going to happen? So, chapter 4. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down. And behold, this closer redeemer that Boaz spoke about came by and Boaz says, friend, or so and so. He remains unnamed. He's the one who could have been in the line of Christ, but because he refuses to operate by his responsibility, he remains unnamed forever. Hey, so-and-so, come here and sit down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city, said, sit down. So they sat down. And then he said to the Redeemer, listen, Naomi has come back to the country and is selling the parcel of land. It belonged to Elimelech. I thought I'd tell you, buy it in the presence of those sitting here. If you will, redeem it. But if not, let me know so I can. He says, I get to increase my land. I'll take it. And he sets it up beautifully, right? How do you appeal to a guy? Sell him a tool or sell him some land. Okay. And so he says, hey, I've got this opportunity for you. He says, yep, I'm in. Doesn't talk to his wife about it. He makes the decision. And then he says, okay, here, good. So when you get the land, you also get the girl. Oh, wait a minute. Because that child is going to take, it's going to cost me money to buy that land. And then that child is going to take that land from me and from my kid. No. Count me out. I don't want anything to do with it. You go ahead and take. In fact, when they refused that, the one who's asking for the right to redemption was supposed to take that shoe off and slap him on the face. He says, here, I'll take my shoe. You take my shoe. You got my slipper. I want nothing to do with this. And in all of this, it comes down then, verse 9. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to her. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I bought to be my wife, so that the name of the dead will not be cut off. And look at how the people react. Verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, yes, we're witnesses. And may the Lord make the woman who's coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthy in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Leah and Tamar are in the blessing as Ruth comes into the home of Boaz. Blessed be the Lord who's not left you this day without a redeemer. The women come up and they gather around Naomi and said, listen, Naomi, you thought God was against you. Look at this baby. The only times that we see God at work, like directly in this story, is back in chapter 1 where it says God visits the people and gives them food. And then up in chapter 4, verse 13, and he went into her and the Lord gave her conception. 10 years she had a husband. 10 years they slept together. 10 years no baby. But she marries Boaz and God gives her conception. And the women say, listen, Naomi, God is for you, not against you. And they named him Obed. And at the end of this story, Naomi, who had turned bitter, is now worshiping the God whose love is for her, not against her. Naomi's transformed. So what is it that transforms her? It's the love of God. The love of God is operative in this whole story. Is this story about Ruth or is it about Naomi? Kind of. But we get down to the end. Verse 17, the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. And here's the whole point. He was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. This is the pay dirt of the sermon. What are the connections of the seed of the woman? First, the book of Ruth is located between Judges and Samuel in order to provide a defense for King David's acceptance before God. Listen, this lady was a Moabite. And who's going to be responsible for bringing and setting up a new temple, a house of God? David, who's part of a Moabite lineage. He should have nothing to do with this house of God for at least 10 generations. But he's allowed in. Why? Because Ruth's heart defines her more than her ethnicity. And what is it that God says about David? He's a man after my own heart. So whenever Ruth is mentioned after that first chapter where she says, I'll take your God to be my God, your people to be my people, whenever it's mentioned that she's a Moabite, she's always a Moabite who's related to an Israelite, always, whether it's the wife of Mahlon or the daughter-in-law of Naomi, but she's a Moabite who's connected to the Israelites because that's her identity. So this Moabite, who along with Tamar and Rahab operates by faith, plays a key role in salvation history. And as you work through the genealogies in all the Hebrew texts, genealogies always come at the beginning and provide the reason for what happens next. Doesn't work that way in the book of Ruth. We're told the story, and then we're told, and here's why it matters, because this is the genealogy. And it's brought about by a woman who lives by faith in the midst of a people who aren't walking by faith. It's an outsider who exercises faith and experiences, like an insider, the reality of this God. Number four, the initiatives of God's grace often move first toward emptiness before ever bringing fullness to God's people. The cross precedes the crown, right? You may be experiencing a time in your life where it feels pretty empty. Listen, empty is never the end of the story for God's people. And it never means God's against you. It just means that in his being for you, he's postponed his fullness. There's more coming. Number five, as the kinsman redeemer of his people, the seed of the woman is related to those who are in need of redemption. Not by his choice, but Boaz is related to Ruth, and he has some responsibility for her. Guess what? By his own choice, your redeemer took on flesh and blood so that he might be your brother. You stand in need of redemption, my friend. The only one who can stand in your place is one who can be related to you. It's because of Christmas that Jesus is. The seed of the woman graciously invites foreigners to eat at his table. That's exactly what Jesus is doing for you. In fact, he generously gives enough to satisfy with leftovers. The feeding of the 5,000, it's one of those beautiful stories. And they all took and they all ate their fill, and there were 12 baskets left over. He's not stingy. He gives you more than you need. We see that this kinsman redeemer focusedly determined to see that the task will be finished. Naomi says, Ruth, don't do anything, because he's going to do everything that it takes to see that it's done today. When Jesus comes to the end of his ministry, he says, okay, it's time for me to go to the cross. And it says he set his face to Jerusalem. And he keeps marching toward that cross, knowing exactly what it's going to cost him, until on that cross he says, okay, now it is finished. This kinsman redeemer sacrificially pays the price to secure his people's welfare. Not everybody could buy that land. Not everybody had enough money to do so. It required somebody who was worthy, who had the sustenance, the wherewithal to do it. Boaz could. Jesus could. How come Jesus didn't hang on that cross for all of eternity, which is the price of my sin, right? Because Jesus is eternal. Jesus had all the resources to pay for all of your sin in those 6 hours on that tree. It's done. It is finished. Paid in full. He had everything that was needed. We see that he publicly satisfied the elders at the gates. But he wasn't inside the gates. He was pushed outside the gates, outside of God's people. We see that he willingly takes a foreigner to be his bride. Don't miss this part of the story. Ruth had no claim on Boaz. We're told that, yes, she married Mahlon, but Mahlon wasn't supposed to marry her. So did Boaz actually have any obligation? That's not the point. He did. He did. And Jesus Christ did for you. And he joyfully offers an abundant future to his bride. Everything that's his is now hers. For how long? Forever. One last thing. He permanently secures honor for himself because of his worthiness. Don't miss that word worthy. He was a worthy man. She was a worthy woman. May you be worthy together within all Israel. Go up to Revelation chapter 5 and we're done this morning. And what is being celebrated around the throne is Jesus Christ has received the title deed of the universe from the Father. What's going to be celebrated is redemption. And what's going to be celebrated is his worthiness. Verse 9 of chapter 5 in the book of Revelation, it says, they sang a new song saying, worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you have redeemed by paying a price. You have ransomed a people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. My friend, the seed of the woman has come to that which is hopeless, so that he might fill us with hope. But that hope isn't for blessing. That hope is for a relationship with him. That's what salvation is. When you get Jesus, you get God. Let's pray.